Our next presenter is Jason Jaggers. Jason shared with me that the last time he presented here, he had just successfully defended his dissertation, and now he's a recent graduate of the Arnold School of Public Health at the University of South Carolina. His primary area of expertise is in clinical exercise, and he's going to be speaking about the effects of acupuncture on psychological stress and viral load in African Americans living with HIV and AIDS. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for attending. This project was part of the, what's known as the Export Grant, and I'll actually, in the acknowledgments in the end, I have spelled out what that stands for, but it was an NIH project that this was funded for minority studies, which is why we did primarily an African American population, which is why we only did an African American population. But also, that's also just the population that is reflective of the HIV as well. Also, that there are, I'd like to report that there are no relationships to disclose. Okay. In the last 15 years, what we have seen is pretty much HIV turning from the virus that causes AIDS, with a life expectancy of 7 to 10 years after diagnosis, become more of a manageable illness with a life expectancy of approximately 20 to 25 years after diagnosis due to the success of antiretrovirals. With highly active antiretroviral therapy, we are no longer seeing AIDS-related deaths, and also we're beginning to see more of a chronic disease developing with this population, dying from illnesses that are more associated with the aging population, such as cardiovascular disease, kidney failure, renal disease, diabetes, and things like that. What we've also seen is an increase in the prevalence due to the decrease in deaths. However, people are still getting infected, an average of 40,000 Americans each year. So we continue to see a steady increase in the prevalence, indicating that more and more people are living with this disease every year. In addition to that, we've also begun to see an increase in the primarily blacks and non-Hispanics becoming infected, as opposed to Caucasians and other minority populations as well. And primarily in the southeastern areas, this is becoming a huge problem with low socioeconomic background populations and African Americans, people that are experiencing health disparities already in addition to having HIV. What this is showing is a model for stress-induced physiological and psychological outcomes in HIV-infected individuals. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this term, but psychoneuroimmunology theory is what this is referring to. And it's pretty much just suggesting that different stressors, both personal and environmental, in our daily lives, can increase the amount of perceived stress or psychological distress that someone experiences, which in turn can induce other stress-induced endocrine, neural, and immune imbalances. And then that, in turn, has different physiological outcomes and also negative health outcomes, which are only going to exacerbate the process. And a critical point to make is that in most cases, the stress response is more dependent on the individual's perception of the stressor than the stressor itself, which can, so the amount of stress someone can experience can vary from person to person. And people living with HIV immediately begin to experience a heightened degree of perceived stress from the moment they're told that they're positive. Just the social stigma living with the disease can increase the amount of stress that they experience. And that stress can exacerbate some negative health outcomes. So with acupuncture treatment, what we would like to say is that it may reduce stress hormone levels, perceived stress, and possibly even enhance immune function. Acupuncture treatment can be done in a group setting, which can offer a cost-effective treatment for HIV-related symptoms, such as this study was done in a group setting. So if you have everybody coming in at once and then an acupuncturist coming in, it's a more feasible and cost-effective way for people that are already experiencing, trouble with healthcare costs. And then also can provide a wide variety of possible treatment settings. However, few studies have examined the effects of acupuncture on stress-associated conditions, or any conditions really, in HIV-positive populations. So the purpose of this particular study was to determine the effects of real and placebo acupuncture on markers of distress and immunity in HIV-positive African Americans. These are the methods. We recruited 77 HIV-infected African Americans, which were randomized into either a real or placebo group. The real acupuncture treatment group received standardized needling twice a week for 5 weeks, and the placebo group received treatment using placebo needles identical in shape and size to the real needles. The difference between the two was that for every subject, we put plastic rings on the sites of where they're beginning the treatment and put tape over those plastic rings. That way, whenever the placebo needle actually hit the skin, the needle would retract into the handle. And then with the tape in the washer there, or the plastic ring, it allowed the needle to stay in place. So they felt the sensation of it touching their skin, but it never actually penetrated the skin. And it was left sticking out, so they could actually look at it going in and look at it during the treatment, as opposed to someone getting the real treatment, which also had the rings on them. And so they were also seeing the same, pretty much the same thing that everybody else was getting. So that's how we administered the placebo treatment. And we did ask at the end of the study who thought they were getting real or placebo treatment, and all but two participants thought they were getting real treatment. The data collected, we sent the blood work out to do at Claflin University. One of our colleagues out there did the plasma viral load for us. And then we also measured perceived stress scale and the symptom distress scale. The data was analyzed using a two-way repeated measure ANOVA with a p-value less than or equal to 0.05. Now, I'm not going to go through these sites one by one or word for word. I just want to include this in the presentation for anyone who may be interested in the sites that we chose. So that way these slides are online. You can go back and look at the presentation if you do wish to see which sites that we chose to use. And those sites were chosen by a licensed acupuncturist who was on the grant with us as well. And then these are also the sites and the primary indications for those who are interested in going back and looking at these slides online. But for time reasons, I'm not going to go through those word for word. And these are a breakdown of the demographics from our population. We had 37 in the real group and 40 in the placebo group. Majority were males. However, we did get some females. Which is another problem with the population. We're beginning to see a huge increase in the number of females becoming infected. The HIV status, most of them reported being HIV asymptomatic, and so on, with symptomatic or AIDS or declined to answer. Majority of them got infected through sexual intercourse or IV drug use, and others indicated that they weren't sure if it was in intercourse or drug use. So if they put both for that, I put that in the other category. We did have about, I think, eight people reported that, and then the other three would just put other. And then majority of them were currently taking a combination antiretroviral. And we also measured medication adherence, and no one changed medications or no one missed a dosage throughout the 5 weeks they were in the study. And no one started new treatments while they were in the study as well. At least they weren't included in the data analysis if they did. Perceived stress scale, we did show a decrease in the intervention group. It was a small decrease, but still it was significant after 5 weeks of treatment. And this is the very interesting finding that we did not expect. We really did not expect to see a change in viral load. However, in the intervention group, there was a small change, but it was significant. So this finding in itself does warrant, I believe, further investigations into looking at acupuncture as a possible complementary and alternative medicine to antiretrovirals. I would never suggest that anyone with HIV stop taking an antiretroviral if they've been put on for obvious reasons. However, as an alternative therapy, if this can be reproduced and shown in another study, that could be a very monumental with this population, I believe. So I just want to point out that we did not expect a decrease in viral load, but the fact that we did see one, it does warrant further investigation. Symptoms did not change. People reported, you know, there was a decreasing trend, however, it was not significant. And the same with symptom distress. And they pretty much mimic one another, indicating that people, as they experience more symptoms, they experience a heightened level of psychological distress because of those symptoms, which can only increase their stress and create, you know, exacerbate conditions and so on and so forth. So in conclusion, these data show that 5 weeks of acupuncture twice a week can help reduce perceived stress and possibly viral load. I'm not sure if I mentioned this earlier, but the sessions lasted 20 minutes. So they received the acupuncture for 20 minutes in each session twice a week. However, we are unable to determine the potential effects of long-term acupuncture or if these effects would be sustained. 5 weeks of acupuncture did not affect the frequency of HIV-related symptoms nor the associated distress, so other possible forms of alternative therapy there may be needed, because we do know that the antiretrovirals do cause large amounts of side effects and related symptoms. And also additional research is warranted to determine potential benefits of acupuncture as a form of complementary alternative medicine in the HIV-infected population. The acknowledgement, I'd like to thank my mentor and advisor, Dr. Gregory Hand, who is the PI of this study. Dr. Don Thompson was our licensed acupuncturist, and Dr. Omar Bagastra from Claflin University, as well as Dr. Samina Nurali. And Dr. Wesley Dudgeon was with the Citadel in Charleston, and he did some of the, he ran a site down there for us to get us some additional 30 subjects. So we did recruit from both the Columbia area and the Charleston, South Carolina area. And the National Institutes of Health, which the EXPORT grant stands for the Center of Excellence and Partnerships, Community Outreach Research on Health Disparities and Training. Are there any questions? I believe now we are taking questions, correct? Okay.
Yes. Okay. So, thank you.
Thank you.
If we could invite all the panel members up. Miriam, too. So we did have a fourth presentation for this session, but someone needed to withdraw at the last minute. So it's just three for today, in case you were here to see that fourth one. And I think that this was just a really wonderful representation of how far the field of integrated therapies has come, to be seeing the different ways that integrated therapies can be incorporated into a clinic or used in research, and then to really see from the NIH that there's a need for more research out there. I'd like to open this up to questions now. Does anybody have any questions for any of the panelists?
What we need to be looking at is how it affects people's functioning. Because different with pain, it's so subjective. Some people will say that they have a lot of pain and will not feel like their daily function is impeded. So I think that's the best way to measure it. We actually used the brief pain inventory, and we did ask all those questions. We just don't have the analysis done for that side of it. And we also had a question in there on self-efficacy, which is measuring how the person reports their feeling of being able to cope. And so for this intervention, I would say we need to be measuring like we're not really looking to reduce people's pain because they're there because their pain is not going away. It's a chronic issue or it's a chronic disease. You don't treat and get rid of sickle cell. So we're looking at just not expecting the pain to go away, but we're expecting efficacy to go up. Like, do you feel you and functioning to go up? So and we do have that data. So we'll continue to analyze that. I don't know if that answers your question.
Personally, I think that there still needs to be more research in various areas of not just public health and diseases, but just the use of alternative and complementary therapies in a range of different populations. And also one thing that I just want to point out, I think it's also important that you be looking at both psychological and physiological variables, because a lot of times people exclude one or the other. You know, if you have psychologists just looking at psychological factors or physiologists looking at just physiological factors, whereas when you combine the two, there's when you leave one out, you're leaving out so many different, I guess, variables that could potentially have, I guess, affect the other, you know, and vice versa. Because like you pointed out with pain, it's both the psychological element and the physiological element. Same thing with HIV, it has both psychological and physiological consequences. So I think that a lot of things with CAM, in other forms of therapies, that it looks at both levels, both how does it benefit psychologically and physiologically.
To build off that a little bit, in our review of school, we found that many of the studies did not control for many things that we would have wanted them to. A lot of them did not focus on just active surveillance patients or people with a certain type of cancer. There are a lot of variables that were just not controlled for, and so that's why in my recommendations we were asking for a large representative sample size and for one CAM at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Can you please explain a little bit about active surveillance?
Okay, so active surveillance is an option while the patient is asymptomatic and the cancer is not deemed to be progressing. And the patient will still see their oncologist regularly and receive regular PSA tests and digital rectal exams to make sure their cancer is not progressing. And this can continue for as long as the oncologist deems it safe. If the cancer does appear to be progressing, then they will put them on a conventional therapy such as chemotherapy or radiation.
I was wondering actually what the normal, I guess, varying levels of PAS, because you were describing how you weren't sure if the decrease in the PAS levels was, like, how to quantify that, yeah.
So currently for the PSA test, under 4 nanograms per milliliter is considered normal, but if it goes above that, they will look for the presence of cancer. But PSA levels, one PSA test by itself is not indicative that you automatically have prostate cancer. It's more the trend over time. So if there is a dip for 1 month, but then it goes back up the next month, then that wouldn't be significant. So that was why I recommended a long follow-up period to make sure it was a real lowering and not just the dip.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of study on renewed focus on PSA right now because of the prevention task force paper, but I'm not exactly sure. Do you mean like if something else?
Well, there are other medications that can change your PSA level. So you've got the same thing going on in the prostate, but the PSA level is getting changed kind of further down the line. So I was just curious if anyone's looked at when you eat soy, is it actually changing something about how the cancer progresses, or is it just changing this kind of secondary measure?
Oh yeah. No, I haven't seen any research on that. That was
why there is a recommendation for further exact correlation between PSA and prostate cancer. Because they do know now that, for instance, you could have a PSA test of over 4 nanograms per milliliter, but that doesn't automatically mean that you have prostate cancer. So that does require further study.
I just
want to
for the one of their slides, it seems like they're, for the control of placebo group, there was an increase in their viral load over time in the graph.
Yes.
And I was wondering if that was significant, and if like, you have any ideas of why that might have been, if it's like natural progression over time, or?
It wasn't significant.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the natural progression over time would be with viral load, but I'm pretty sure it fluctuates daily. Can't say 100% sure, but I think that was just a random effect with that group, which is why it makes the fact that we saw one line going up and one going down makes me more excited with some sort of
question about it, too. With antiretroviral therapy, what do you expect the viral load to be?
When they first start treatment, you expect it to be decreasing. Also, some people get to the point where they're undetectable. However, whenever you've been maintaining an antiretroviral regimen, eventually, I can't say for sure, but I mean, I think it has like a plateau effect. You can decrease it to the point where it's not detectable, and it can still possibly continue to decrease it. But I would have expected that to be an even bigger decrease if it was due to the antiretrovirals. But that's another thing we can't say for sure that it wasn't, because we didn't include both people taking antiretrovirals and people not taking antiretrovirals. When I removed the people who were not taking antiretrovirals from the analysis, it still was significant. It still showed that decrease. And it still showed the decrease with when I looked at people just who were not taking antiretrovirals. But it wasn't significant, and I think that was because of just lack of power. Yes.
So, on the same study, did you also look at the number of T cells, maybe for T cells, or the activity of the T cells?
We actually did have them self-report that from their last doctor visit. I'm not sure why it wasn't included in the overall analysis of their blood work. But we didn't actually measure that ourselves. We did a self-report. From the ones that we did have, there was no significant difference from what they reported. But I don't think they necessarily reported accurately on the 5-week follow-up.
And I have a follow-up question. So do you have any inclusion, basically go a little bit more to your inclusion criteria, like at which point in time did you recruit the patients?
The primary inclusion criteria was that they had to be a minority population. They didn't necessarily have to be African Americans. It was open to all minorities. African Americans were just the ones that we just happened to get. They had to be acupuncture naive, meaning that they'd never had acupuncture treatment before. They had to be able to read and write at a 6th grade level, just to be able to understand the questionnaires that we were giving them. Other than that, at first, we only opened it up to people taking antiretrovirals, but the population is so hard to recruit that eventually we had to open it up to both people on and off medications. And then exclusion criteria, if they missed more than 2 sessions of the acupuncture treatment, they were dropped from the study. But those are the primary. There was a list of different types of what I'm looking for. Opportunistic infections, sorry.
Okay. So what is the dropout rate?
It was about 35% to 40%, and that's because a lot of people had 2 absences.
Okay. So did you see any differences in terms of dropout rates comparing both arms? Do you see that acupuncture helped in
There was no difference as far as whether they were in the real or placebo group if they dropped out. nobody voluntarily dropped out, but due to the effects of acupuncture, if they had missed more than two, it was determined by the acupuncturist that if you missed more than two sessions, the results, we wouldn't be able to tell if it's from the treatment or if it's just by chance. So they, the ones that were ended up being dropped out were there were is because they missed those two sessions, but nobody voluntarily dropped out. And I didn't actually go through and analyze from the two groups as far as the dropouts.
Thank you.
I'm just curious how you conducted group acupuncture session. How many in a group? How many acupuncturists per person? Is it all in the same room?
Yes, we did it in waves. We would recruit, and once we got a group of about 10 to 15 people ready to begin, sometimes we got up to 20 people. We had them all come in at between the hours of 5 and 7 p.m. on two set days that were good for the acupuncturist, and so we made sure that we kept, you know, whether it's Monday and Wednesday or Tuesday and Thursday, we always gave them that two-hour window on those 2 days a week to come in, and they were compensated $20 for each session that they attended, which I think helped keep a lot of them in the study. And it was all done in the same room. We had reclining chairs, we had plastic lawn chairs with footrest for them to be as comfortable as possible, provided with pillows if they if their back was hurting or if they needed some more comfort there. But they were all in the same room, received the treatment, but then at the same time, but the acupuncturist would go from one to the other, and we prepared the sites as far as putting the actual rings on them and taking the site, the markers for the acupuncturist. And they weren't necessarily on one side of the room or the other. Everybody was kept, I guess they were able to sit wherever they chose. So we didn't put the placebo people with just them, the real people with just them. And majority of the staff were blinded by the group. I wasn't, just because I had to tell the acupuncturist which group the person was in. But I didn't really do the data collection sessions. But yeah, it was a group setting all at the same time. And, well, not all at the same time. Like I said, they had a two-hour window. I'm sorry. So they could come in. For the most part, they all arrived at the same time. They were very, every now and then someone would come in a little late, but they came as a group for the most part. Something you can purchase. The company was Asia Med. I believe they're located in Florida, if I'm not mistaken. They sell both the real needles, and then also they developed a placebo needle, which no one has actually tested yet. So we were one of the first studies to actually look at its effectiveness in being a placebo treatment, which is why we asked them at the end if they thought they were being real or placebo treatment. And majority of them, like I said, all but two thought they were being real treatment. And one thing I didn't say in the study was it was actually a 10-week study. At the 5-week period, we would re-randomize people so they could either switch from the real to the placebo group or vice versa. I didn't include that data because we had so many dropouts after that point, just because it was hard to keep them in without missing two sessions for the whole 10 weeks. But even if they switched from the real to the placebo, they still thought they were getting real acupuncture.
I have a question for you. So you collected data from the first visit to the last visit, right?
Yeah.
And you compared the change between the pain and the stress. How did you know this is going to be the last visit?
Well, we don't, but we made the cutoff a certain amount of time. So this tells us from September to May how they're doing. So if they wanted to continue, if that patient continues and they want to continue analyzing, they'll take their very first visit, and they'll take their last next year, and they can do it that way. I analyze people's very first visit, compared beginning and the end of that visit, plus I analyzed everybody's first visit compared to their last. So we knew when they came. So someone's last visit is different. It's different for each person.
You would do the intake of their levels of pain retrospectively? Because
we have every time somebody comes, they fill out a pre-test and they answer how their pain is doing, and then before they leave that day, they they fill out a post-test.
Oh.
So, yeah, so the post-tests were analyzed. Yeah.
At least one of the points that was on there was a point that's also an acupressure point. And I think there may have been a second one as well. So how can you tell if you're actually doing something with pressure that you're not having an effect that it's truly placebo?
I'm not familiar with the whole acupuncture procedure, but all I know is that all they felt was just the sensation of the needle touching the skin. It didn't actually apply pressure the constant time. So I'm not sure if we can say for sure if it was just the pressure point. However, from what my experience with the acupuncture placebo needles is all you feel is just that immediate touch in the skin, and then for the most part the tape just kind of holds the needle in place, and after that it's not even really touching the skin much, but it's possible some of them we could have been, or it could have been applying that pressure, so I can't say for sure, but that's a very good point.
One of the ways that we deal with that in our clinic at Boston, where we do quite a bit of HIV-related research as well, is that we use clinically neutral points as the comparison placebo points. So they're nearby, but they're not an identified point that has a particular clinical effect.
And there has been in the literature discussion of whether there is such a thing as truly neutral points. Not that you can go there.
Right.
And I know the one in the ears that we used for the people in the placebo group, all we could really do was put one ring to tape it to the ear. And so the acupuncturist would go and just put three needles. Because we had three different sites in the ear, I believe, three or four. And so he would just put those three or four in that same spot where the staff would put the washers or the plastic rings. So some of those the placebo group received, I guess, different areas, but just the ears.
I've got a question about your pain management. You said at baseline you asked how many of the average number of pain meds each person, each patient is taking.
It's not that number. It was if it was a self-reported if they felt their medicine was effective for their pain. So 33.
So you look at how much or what each person was taking.
We have that as well. It hasn't been.